Public Safety Subcommittee for Thursday, March 17, 2005. We're holding a public hearing on Senate Bill 5530, the Oregon Youth Authority. Good afternoon, Mr. Jester. Tell us how you'd like to proceed this afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I would like to start today with Karen Olson, who is our Assistant Director of Business Services, and she will present our capital budget section in your notebook.
And Ms. Olson, does 10 minutes feel adequate to you?
I can do it, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Karen Olson, the Assistant Director of Business Services for the Oregon Youth Authority. I'll be starting on page 57 in your notebooks. Brian discussed facility operations yesterday. Today, I'm going to briefly discuss facility assets, namely the land and the buildings that we operate those facilities in. We have a physical capacity of 1,131 close custody beds, and the governor's budget funds operation of 850 of those. At the top of page 57 in this chart, I just wanted to highlight some points here for you to give you some context around our physical assets. On the left-hand side of the chart, we list two facilities, McLaren and Hillcrest, which you visited in your tours. Over one half of the capacity of OIA's close custody is in these two facilities. On average, the structures are older. These are large, multi-building campuses. McLaren has about 250,000 square feet of space. And you'll notice at the bottom you can see that 106 of these beds are currently empty. In the middle part of the chart, we have five facilities. These are newer structures, and they're generally smaller. And at least in the first four of the facilities, the construction is it's very different from McLaren and Hillcrest. It's very contained, and it's very consistent, since those facilities were all built on the same design. These facilities were also built, in some cases, to house county detention. They are also tend to be more energy efficient than Hillcrest or McLaren because they're newer. And we do have the ability to centrally program heating, ventilation, and air conditioning. 150 of the state beds are empty in these facilities, and 10 county detention beds are empty. And the top four facilities are also the source of OIA's only debt service. Over on the right-hand side of the chart, you see four facilities. They're a mix in terms of age. They're generally small. Two of the camps have just 5,000 square feet each. These facilities provide work and experience in and within the community. The newest structure is in LeGrand, and 25 beds in LeGrand are empty. At McLaren and Hillcrest, some of you saw what we call temporary structures. We have 100 beds of temporary structures at McLaren. These are their buildings. They're soft-sided structures. They look like, kind of like Quonset huts. 50 of the beds are still in use. 50 of those are empty. They were built to have a lifespan of about 10 to 12 years, and we have had some problems with them in terms of the fabric that is the outside is tensioned over a ribbing structure, and the fabric rips, and so we have to repair it from time to time. We also have 50 temporary beds at Hillcrest. Those will be vacated by the end of the biennium in terms of residential use, and we will use those for some other purpose. On page 58,
Madam Chair.
Representative Hannah.
Thank you. Ms. Olson, on the left-hand side of your chart, the 106 empty beds, does that include the 50 that are available in the soft side structures?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, yes, it does.
So if the soft side structures were gone, there'd only be 56 available beds, right? Because we're, or Well, we're using 50 beds now, but you could have 100 beds in the soft structures.
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah.
So if the soft structures were gone, follow up, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. If the soft structures were gone, there'd be 6 beds.
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Please, another
one
question?
One more follow-up, please.
Certainly.
Scott Hall is where?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, Scott Hall is at Hillcrest.
And could you elaborate just a little bit on that remodel?
Certainly. Representative Hannah, we received funding from the federal government, the program called the Violent Offender Incarceration Truth and Sentencing Act, to remodel Scott Hall. We had not used Scott Hall since about 1998 because its interior structure was a series of individual rooms, and it was difficult to provide for youth safety in those rooms. So in our remodel, we've opened up the entire interior of 4 units there, and we'll be when we finish the construction in May, we'll be moving youth into those areas.
And one more. Mm-hmm. So how many beds will be available in Scott Hall?
We'll have about 100 beds available in Scott Hall.
Thank you.
Ms. Olson, just for further clarification, on the youth correctional facilities side, the Eastern, North Coast, Rogue Valley, et cetera, are those co-ed?
Madam Chair, they are not. They're male only.
All right.
The only co-ed facility we have is Hillcrest Youth Correctional Facility.
Okay. Thank you.
Moving to page 58. I do need to make you aware of one issue within our facilities, and that is Whitaker Hall at McLaren Youth Correctional Facility is a building that's 78 years old, and it's in need of significant repairs. We did request from the governor funding to replace Whitaker Hall, but we understand that with the state's fiscal situation, this is probably not the time to do it. We will need to do something at some point. The third floor of the building is condemned, and the building is essentially sinking. We have a 4-year capital improvement management plan. We use this funding for small capital improvements to keep facilities from deteriorating and also to replace equipment and other items. We have a number of projects on that plan. Most of these are at McLaren, Hillcrest, and the older transition camps. However, our newer facilities are getting to be about 8 to 10 years old, and I think in future biennia you may hear us coming back and talking to you about the need for increased capital improvement funding for the newer facilities. And now, in terms of the way we measure our performance, one of the areas that we can impact the performance of the organization is around our energy usage. In 2000, the governor set targets for energy usage, reducing 10% from 2000 levels. OYA has met or exceeded the targets ever since 2003 for both electrical and natural gas consumption. The last piece of this presentation is on page 59. We'll briefly talk to you about our debt service. As I said, we have one source of debt service. It is the 4 regional facilities that we have. We, during last biennium, the Department of Administrative Services was able to get us a lower interest rate on those bonds. We're now at 4.25%. They will be paid off in about 2012. And this, our debt service at $6.6 million general fund is $4 million lower next biennium than it is currently. That ends my presentation. If you have any questions,
Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to back up to Whitaker Hall for just a moment. Do you know approximately the square footage of the replacement building that's being considered?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, I think it's about 19,000 square feet.
So you're talking about a $2.7 million building?
Mm-hmm.
Has any is there a development plan for that building, or where is the process on that building or planning stage?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, we did go through a planning process, and we know the functions that we want in the building. One of the things we would like to do is to not have the building within the fence, but to site it across the fence so that visitors would have easier access when they're visiting youth. We also would look at the uses for the building and expand those of the current administration building.
Follow-up. Did that cost estimate include demolition of the old facility?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, it does not.
Would it be in the plan to do demolition of the old facility?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, I don't know that we're planning to do that at this point.
Let me stay with this just for a minute. What, I guess, why would we leave a building that has a condemned third floor inside the, you know, what would its purpose be?
Representative Hanna, sometimes buildings like that can be used for just general storage. I think the issue for us would be the cost to try to keep some use of the building going versus the cost of demolition of that building.
Thank you.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What kind of structure are you looking at? Was it a prefab metal, or is it a brick and mortar?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, it's a brick and mortar type building.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Olson. We appreciate your presentation and all of your preparation for it.
Thank you.
Community and Program Services, is that where you'd like to go next?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, at this time I'd like to introduce Robin Cole, who is the Assistant Director of Oregon Youth Authority's Community Services.
And Ms. Cole, we're looking at about 40 minutes for your presentation.
That would work. Thank you.
Okay, great.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robin Cole. I am the Assistant Director of Field Operations for the Oregon Youth Authority, and I'll be sharing community and program services with you today. The goal of community and program services is the delivery of overarching case management for youth offenders throughout the state. We have juvenile parole and probation officers that provide supervision and coordinate services in all 36 counties. We do so in collaboration with many, many partners. In these next few minutes, I will explain how we are woven into our communities. In terms of the overall Youth Authority budget, community and program services represents 40% of the budget. We contract 51% of our budget to residential and foster care services, and 17% goes directly to counties for juvenile crime prevention, diversion, and gang services. We're primarily general funded, but 25% of our funds are federal funds, primarily federal Medicaid funding. Page 62 reflects a brief overview of our services.
Representative
Hanna. Madam Chair, thank you. The piece on the bottom of page 61, bottom left graph, indicates the 17% spent on juvenile crime prevention, diversion, and gang-related. Could you expand on the juvenile crime prevention piece?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, absolutely. Those funds, 17%, goes directly to counties, and later in my presentation I will share with you exactly the kinds of services, but specifically the juvenile crime prevention are funds that are provided to counties to serve, they develop programs that aid in the prevention of youth penetrating the juvenile system, specifically things like assessment. They support shelter services and other kinds of treatment prevention programs in the community.
Madam Chair, follow-up. Is this the piece that comes through State Commission on Children and Families, the JCP dollars?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, it is, in fact, separate. These are funds that we provide directly to counties through agreements and contracts.
Ms. Baker, would you like to comment?
Yes, please. Madam Chair, Representative Hanna,
Senate Bill 555 in 1999 established juvenile crime prevention monies, part of which was targeted for what the more prevention piece, which was put in the Criminal Justice Commission, and that's what's proposed to now move to the Commission on Children and Families budget. The other piece of that was what they call juvenile crime prevention dollars for basic services, which was more, I don't want to say more oriented to, well, it was for things like county juvenile departments to do detention, more intense services than the pure prevention side of the dollars that the juvenile crime prevention got. So if you look at it on a continuum, what's in the OIA budget is closer towards the close custody end of the continuum than the other juvenile crime prevention dollars that are proposed to be now in the Commission on Children and Families budget. So it's a piece of the whole, but they're different pots of money.
Continue.
Thank you, Ms. Baker. I appreciate having that clarification. Madam Chair, I would like to suggest that we vet this subject much closer, and unless there is some great attachment to this that we would want to understand from you, that it seems like it's the only juvenile prevention piece here, and as we've had the discussion, it ends up being the only juvenile prevention piece within children and families. And these are the type of things I'd like to make sure that we're spending enough time on to understand why they're different and how come they're not the same at the same time. That's clear.
Very, very clear and very astute observation. It would also be very helpful, Ms. Cole and also Mr. Jester, if you would comment on, proportionately speaking, are we investing adequately in juvenile crime prevention and diversion services, given our experience with the population served by the Oregon Youth Authority, given our experience over a period of time now, going back to 1995, again, is our investment at the level where it should be, or should we be doing something differently?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would like to give a brief answer and then provide some additional data for you at a later time, perhaps during phase two, on that specific question. Both those funding streams, the diversion dollars as well as the juvenile crime prevention basic, were reduced during the period of time that Oregon Youth Authority was reducing its capacity to serve young people, and that reduction also affected our community side, and they are not at the level that they have been in the past. So the short answer is there is less money there than there has been in the past, but we will be more definitive about what the cause and effect of that is.
Okay. That would be very helpful. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mrs. Cole, you mentioned 41% of your expenditure from community and program services is contracted out. Could you confirm that number, and is that across the different foster care and juvenile prevention and parole, or where is that 41% contracting out? And are they are you using performance-based measures to those people who are receiving those contracts?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, yes, I believe I think the number that you're referencing is the residential and foster care services. And that, in fact, is almost 50% that we work with in terms of our providers in the community. And that's both residential as well as outpatient therapy services. The answer to the question regarding how we are looking at measures, we do, in fact, use a couple of different measures. One, Ms. Rios spoke to the correctional program inventory yesterday. and that's one measure we use specifically with our residential providers. And so both with facilities and providers, we are implementing and utilizing that measure to determine program effectiveness. Secondly, we are implementing with our providers the evidence-based practices. Most recently, functional family therapy is a solicitation that we have just moved forward with. Multisystemic therapy, another. So we're, our expectation is that providers will come forward and work with us on the delivery of those evidence-based practices.
Madam Chair, Bond.
Certainly.
Thank you. That's good information. But I thought in your testimony you said you contract out 40%, I thought I wrote down, that you of your...
Didn't get the number.
And that's what I was looking for. Was that correct? Is 40% of these services are contracted out, and they are they, you know, in all the areas, or just one area of foster care? Or what?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, if I misrepresented, I do apologize for that. We are 40% of the Youth Authority's overall budget, I can certainly make attempts to clarify that information for you.
No, it could be my hearing. Thank you.
It would be accurate to say that we don't have enough information yet on how effective the family, the functional family therapy and the multi-system therapy approaches will be with the population. We're just starting these efforts, and so after what period of time should we expect to be able to talk about outcomes effectiveness?
Madam Chair, excellent question. As evidence-based therapies, we are working on, first of all, implementing them, and we certainly will monitor and track their effectiveness. I would anticipate Ms. Rios being able to assist us with time frames, probably a year out or 2 years out, but that specific question, I guess I am unprepared to answer. I'd be happy to get, again, some specific time frames around that for you.
In phase two, colleagues and Ms. Baker, this is going to be one of the pieces that we take a closer look at around performance measures and trying to set some parameters for our expectations. Mr. Jester?
Madam Chair, Bob Jester, I would like to just add, Ms. Cole is absolutely right that when you look at our overall measure of recidivism, in other words, do youth who leave a program, close custody or a residential program or a service, commit another law violation within 12, 24, 36 months out, we would be looking at those youth who completed these evidence-based program services and their 12-month out, 24-month out, and 36-month out history, and we would be comparing that against the cohort that did not have those services. That would be one of the ways that we would look at whether they were making an impact on this population in Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Representative Hansen, did you have a question?
No.
Okay. Please continue.
Okay. Picking up on page 62. Community and Program Services provides for public safety, youth accountability, and reformation, as I said, primarily through coordination in local communities and through partnerships. We do so with a primary partner, our Oregon County Juvenile Departments. We've established co-management agreements and actually negotiated co-management agreements with all 36 local juvenile departments. How we operate is the discussion around the priority of resources, efficiency in utilizing our resources, and what our local responsibilities are to youth and families. And I'd like to give you an example of how that actually operates. It's called different things in different counties. In Multnomah County, for instance, it's called an alternative placement committee. In Clackamas and Marion County, it's a placement committee. With our good friends in the central and eastern part of the state, it's called a community resource team. But essentially, it is a multidisciplinary process where I think the question came up about how education is incorporated in planning with youth. Education comes together, the Department of Human Resources, we have local county mental health, families, juvenile department, the youth authority, and we staff these youth, taking a look at what assessment of public safety risk is, what the strengths of a youth and family are, what the treatment needs of a youth are, their educational needs, and we actually make recommendations to the court about how a youth is best served. And so these functions are occurring across the state for youth that are entering the system or entering youth authority custody, if you would, whether it be probation or into a youth correctional facility or back into the community. And so these co-management agreements actually outline how we operationalize our work between a county jurisdiction or the juvenile department and OYA. And I think it's become a very effective tool in terms of how we collaborate and make most efficient use of our resources locally. In addition, other critical partners that we work with are contracted residential providers as well as our contracted therapy providers. They have assisted us in the continued change in delivery of services that we have made together, and a functional family therapy would be a very good example of bringing an evidence-based service into the youth authority's array of services in terms of what our juvenile parole and probation officers are able to select from as they are building case plans. Another example of that would be independent living. As youth are aging out of the system, they're requiring more and more emancipation skill development. And so we have providers that are offering that level of service to youth. We support the rights of victims through accountability and reformation and restitution activities. Our juvenile parole and probation officers provide oversight in terms of completion of restitution. And additionally, we work towards continuous improvement in the delivery of culturally competent services.
Do we have a performance measure, help me recall, related to restitution?
Madam Chair, I do not believe we have a performance measure directly related to restitution. However, we do, in fact, track the completion of restitution and community service hours.
Okay, let's flag that one, too.
The chart in the middle of page 62 is a demonstration.
Before you go there,
sure.
Ms. Cole, looking at the menu in the community reformation services box, looking at that menu,
mm-hmm.
Where are we deficient in capacity, community capacity, to provide the programs and services that serve the needs of your population?
Madam Chair, I guess I would begin with deficiencies in mental health treatment. I think that's probably our most significant deficit area. I would probably list secondly sex offender treatment opportunities for youth. And thirdly, I would add inpatient secure drug and alcohol opportunities in the community for youth. And this is both male and female.
And the deficiencies, are they statewide?
Madam Chair, yes.
What was third?
Okay.
We have, however, in fact, responded as best we can to the needs of youth as they have posed challenges with treatment needs and developed this group of services for them and with our contracted residential and treatment providers. And so this chart is, in fact, an illustration of what we do have available currently. Page 63 speaks to who it is we serve in the community. Our youth are represent 25%, 25% of our youth are youth of color. Our gender, 17% are young women, approximately twice that of our partners in close custody. In terms of types of crime, almost half of the youth in the field are committed on property offenses, and two-thirds of our youth are under the age of 18. I'd like to next move to
Representative. I had some trial lawyers in yesterday talking to me, and I relayed to them. We talked about the property issue, about how that could raise that, and it would help. And they said it's actually $750 now, but that they would be good to raise that even more. And there have been efforts to do that, so it's still something we could look at as we look at how to reduce the workload throughout the
community. We'll make a note of that as well. Thank you.
I'd like to next take you into the actual service delivery area a little more in detail. Begin on page 64 with parole and probation services. We have juvenile parole and probation officers across the state that provide supervision and coordinate case planning for youth who are committed to OYA. This chart here on my left illustrates how case management is coordinated across the state. Juvenile parole and probation officers provide that overarching case management function. And you heard Mr. Jester speak to that in terms of youth entering the system on probation, the youth correctional facilities, and then out to parole. And if I could just try to briefly walk through what exactly it is or put a face to what a parole officer does in the course of performing their work. And I'm sorry, I'll try not to get you while I do a little bit of this. So a youth is committed to us on probation when there is a determination, and that's this first group here, when there's a determination that there is a need for an out-of-home placement, and the determination is made by the court. There's a need for an out-of-home placement where there's a requirement for additional structure, that a youth is in need of additional structure, when additional accountability is required, or there's a public safety risk. And our juvenile parole and probation officers attend those committees I just spoke to, those collaborations that we are involved in each of our communities, and those multidisciplinary staffings occur. And we take a look at the strength of the families, the strengths the youth possess, the level of risk, what education a youth needs. All of those pieces come together. And we administer the risk needs assessment that Ms. Rios spoke to. We design a case plan, and we plan for those probation services in the field or in the community. If a youth continues to escalate, if a youth continues to pose a risk or poses a risk to public safety, if they fail to meet the conditions of probation, if they commit a new crime, a youth then penetrates the next level of service, and a judge will commit a youth to the youth correctional facilities. And I know many of you had the opportunity to tour McLaren or Hillcrest. And so our parole officers then coordinate the case management in tandem with the treatment managers at the youth correctional facilities. And at the point a youth enters a youth correctional facility, we begin the transition planning. And so we're always a step or two ahead in terms of what a youth is going to need when he or she reenters the community. What's the next step? In the meantime, we work with our treatment managers and facilities around treatment planning progress, treatment goal design, and exactly what the transition plans need to look like and will look like. We will make referrals to residential programs in the community. We will work with families. We will work with other youth advocates of the youth and family to pull together a comprehensive plan for that eventual community placement. When the youth completes their transition or their treatment program, he or she then will move out onto parole status. And again, we'll provide that direct supervision for a youth in the community. They transition to that less restrictive environment. We'll provide the direct supervision. We'll work with the families in the community again. We partner with a variety of resources to include, again, the residential providers that we've made the referrals to, with mental health, with employment, make sure the victim's piece is coordinated around restitution and accountability. And here's where Mr. Jester spoke to the Citizens Review Board and the courts, the review hearings in the courts. Both with probation and with parole, our parole officers appear at scheduled intervals before Citizens Review Boards and the courts to ensure that our case planning is on target and is appropriate and meets the needs of youth and families. In addition, there was a question about coordination with the faith community. Always, we work with advocacy roles with the faith community, and that is considered certainly one of the strengths with the families, so we coordinate there. We have a few direct mentors and coaches within the faith community that work specifically with our youth in the community. And I guess I would also offer, with our Native American community, we've collaborated on the development of foster homes, the coordination, direct coordination around transition planning, which is a significant piece with our youth, as well as the ceremonial sweat lodge ceremonies. And that's the cleansing ceremonies that occur within the Native community. And so we really incorporate that faith-based piece within both the treatment and the transition case planning within community services. So to try to put that picture on in terms of what the role of the parole officer is and how they provide those services, they're really the liaison in terms of coordinating or brokering the therapy services and the services in the community. They're the main link, as you can see, that follows a youth through the OYA continuum of care. They represent the youth authority in court and within the Citizens Review Board, and they serve as a youth advocate in the connection with the family.
What's the current average caseload for a parole and probation officer?
Madam Chair, that does vary across the state. However, the average runs somewhere between 22 to 24.
What's the national standard?
Madam Chair, I should be able to answer that, and I apologize for not being able to give you that answer, but I'd be happy to provide it.
Thank you.
If I could direct your attention to page 65. As youth are moving out of facilities or are on probation status, many of them are not able to remain at home. As I indicated, the court will require us to provide some out-of-home care for probation youth, or when they're coming out of facilities, they simply are not able to move directly back in home. And so the Youth Authority looks to residential and foster care services to provide a supervised living environment. It provides a respite from families as well as a chance for youth to focus on intensive treatment. They simply need intensive treatment opportunities. 15% of our capacity provides resources specifically for young women. We have programs that are tailored to meet the needs of our youth of color. And again, these programs do provide services for both probation and parole youth. Page 66 is an illustration of...
Before you go to 66, I really appreciate the thoroughness of your presentation. Do we have enough capacity to meet the needs of the different cultural groups and of girls in our system? Are there challenges there that we should be aware of?
Madam Chair, that's an excellent question. Interesting to try to answer that for you. I believe that we experienced a proportionate reduction in our residential programs for all offenders, and we meet the demands or the placement of youth by risk. And typically young women, I'll start there, young women tend to pose a lower risk but have a higher need. And so in the community, I would suggest that the placement of youth in programs is predicated on risk and need. And so we can always improve in terms of delivering additional services and additional capacity. Certainly we can always build upon and enhance the ability to serve in the community. And I think similarly with youth of color, the challenge becomes the development of programs and the sustainability. And the answer is yes.
Are you able to meet the current demands? That's a no.
I would say, Madam Chair, we will always be able to do better. And I don't believe that we currently are able to meet the residential capacity. And again, looking at the specific needs of youth, they all have different profiles. If there's a mental health component as well, that's where we fall short in terms of youth that have mental health needs, youth that have drug and alcohol needs, and the sex offender population. In those three areas, I think that's the three areas that we could definitely improve upon, both for young women and youth of color.
Thank you.
Page 66 is an illustration of our currently contracted residential programs. And if I could just highlight a few of those programs for you. There was a question about the JBAR program earlier this week, and we do currently contract with JBAR-J in Bend. We try to provide services, I should say, across the state for all youth. And this is a good representation of again, where they're contracted. Oregon City, the Parrot Creek program, I would suggest, not only serves in a residential capacity, but additionally they're a provider of functional family therapy services. In Medford, Community Work serves young men and young women. In Portland, there are a number of programs. Pettigrove, Rosemont, Salvation Army all provide services specifically to young women. Salvation Army for expectant mothers and new mothers has been a longstanding program in the Portland area. Morrison, Janus, Youth Progress, all of them work have worked many years with a diverse population. In Salem, we have Street Visions that works primarily with Latino youth. So again, I think a representation of the number of providers across the state.
What should we understand about those areas of the state that don't have a little dot? Speak to us about access, how that happens.
Madam Chair, I think part of the challenge is just that, the geographic challenge. We can certainly place youth wherever there is a program, but I think part of the difficulty is the siting, the establishment of programs. And maybe I don't have all the answers to that. I would suggest that the Janet Ahrens and the Alliance and the current providers that we work with have done an outstanding job in meeting the needs of youth and probably might be better apt to help us explain that answer.
Please continue.
Thank you. I'd like to now share the foster care services with you. We have approximately 100 foster homes across the state that provide a family living environment for youth, different than the residential services I just spoke to. We now are talking about a family living environment. They're similar to surrogate parents that open their homes to youth and enable youth to have a least restrictive setting. And these are open to both probation and parole youth. As surrogate parents, foster parents will do things like take youth to school, to treatment appointments. They'll take them to work. And if they're having a problem, the expectation is that foster parents will work with the juvenile parole and probation officer, work through those challenges, and assist the youth in resolving them and work with the PO on that. Because we have found that certain youth have a more specific need or need a more tailored level of treatment and intervention, the Youth Authority is enhancing the capacity of multidimensional treatment foster care. It isn't an evidence-based program, It is an evidence-based practice, and it focuses on comprehensive support and services for youth and the parents and foster parents. So typically, foster care provides a home environment where treatment is focused outside of the home, and multidimensional treatment foster care incorporates treatment and the foster parents in the delivery of the treatment service. With both residential services, with foster care, as well as youth living in the home, what we have found is a supplemental level of treatment and support services are many times required to assist the youth in being successful in the community. And page 68 begins to speak to individualized community services. And that is a level of service that oftentimes helps to, again, to supplement that youth treatment environment while in the community. for instance, we have a sex offender that has been at McLaren and participated in treatment, and when he is returning to the community, that level of transition needs to be supported. The sex offender transition provides ongoing treatment and support services for that youth returning to the community on parole status. Minority youth transition promotes a positive transition from OYA close custody facilities. Transition and independent living services will incrementally decrease supervision while building vocational skills and job placement assistance. And this is what I specifically spoke to with the JBAR-J program in Bend. And Rick O'Dell and his program is assisting us with this independent living emancipation program. Functional family therapy, again, Parrot Creek is assisting us here, is a family therapy program proven successful with delinquent youth and families who have been resistant to traditional therapies. And finally, multi-systemic therapy. It's an intensive family and community-based treatment that's proven successful with serious antisocial youth. There was a question regarding the 17% of funds transferred to counties. These funds, through agreements, are transferred to counties for delinquency prevention and intervention services to meet the needs of youth offenders who might otherwise be committed to the youth authority. Originating in 1985, diversion funds are provided to counties to develop a continuum of services in the community. These community-based options are intended to divert youth offenders from youth correctional facilities. Later, juvenile crime prevention basic funds were established to aid in prevention services for high-risk, non-adjudicated youth. These funds are to further enhance ability to identify at-risk youth. The graph in the middle of the page, the chart in the middle of the page, illustrates some of the services that are available through the county funding. Shelter and detention services, intensive probation, alcohol and drug, treatment foster, functional family therapy are some of the examples. And youth gang services are gang funds that address the needs of gang-involved youth, primarily youth offenders in Multnomah County. Some of the funds support community services, enhanced supervision, and case management. And this has been a 12-year effort specifically within Multnomah County. Page 70 speaks to our program office, which provides support services and quality assurance for juvenile justice. Within the program office, Community Resources provides development and monitoring of contracts around purchased residential services. Treatment support provides technical assistance and the delivery of appropriate health care and behavioral health services. Training, development and delivery of safety, security, treatment, and management training for Oregon Youth Authority and our juvenile justice partners. We have a research and development function. We have a rules and policy section that coordinates and maintains policy based on national best practice and legislative intent. And I would suggest it's not a section, it's an individual. So I need to correct that. And program and evaluation, which provides quality assurance and ongoing assessment to program and evaluates effectiveness. Page 71 illustrates, again, community and program services, of which we are 17% of the staff within the Youth Authority. And the chart will show you exactly the areas that we are responsible for. And if I could then direct you to performance-based measures. As Mr. Florip has shared yesterday, and I think Mr. Jester has also shared, it is a system of collecting and analyzing data to improve custody, supervision, and reformation services. Community and Program Services has three measures. The first speaks to, and they all, are specific to contracted residential programs. The first speaks to residential runaways from provider supervision. And as you can see, there is a slight decrease in the trend from 2002 to 2004. And we are slightly off the target there. Although we continue to make improvement, there are a couple things. First, the evidence-based practices that we've recently implemented with regards to our risk needs assessment and our evidence-based services and the multidisciplinary processes, I think we believe will better enable us to match youth to programs, and we hope to see a better outcome here in terms of meeting our target line. I would also add that 25% of the youth that run away are returned to program. The rest are placed in detention, where we will have the opportunity then to look at the case plans and retool those case plans. Measure 10 speaks to injuries, again, in residential programs. And you can see that there's a slight increase from 2002 to 2004. And we are, in fact, off that trend line. Probably some discussion here about the nature of the injuries that we experience. First, we require the residential programs to report all injuries. Secondly, the nature of the injuries are broad. It can be a non-structured recreational activity, for instance, youth playing basketball within the courtyard of a residential facility. It can be a sports-related injury in a school sports activity, a football game, or something occurring in PE. It can be an assault-related activity within a residential program. So that's the scope of the kinds of injuries involved here.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As we discussed yesterday, again, I think this reporting of this style of the combination of injuries is somewhat irrelevant to this committee, and of more relevance would be injuries that are a direct result of providers or contractors, interaction between the two, not basketball injuries and such. I think we need to narrow that scope.
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, I thank you for your comment. I completely agree, and we will make that adjustment. And the final performance measure, Measure 11, consideration of Representative Hanna's comment. I would suggest that it is a difficult measure to read, in that it looks rather startling on its presentation. I would suggest that there are two concerns with the measure. It is regarding suicidal behavior. The measure speaks to, as Mr. Florup suggested yesterday, there was a change in the incorporation of the definition. So although it does not reflect additional occurrences because of the broadening of the definition, there is a change in what is included then in the bar, so the growth in the bar. And the second piece here is the target line. There was an error in the projections. And the Office of Economic Development allows periodic changes to the target line. So we were not able to make those changes we were able to make them within a certain window of time. And so you'll see that the target line adjustment was made closer to 2005-06. And that concludes my presentation, unless there are other questions.
When you are back before us in the next phase, I'm looking now back at page 70, and the final bullet on that page talks about program evaluation and quality assurance provides ongoing assessment of programs to evaluate effectiveness. It would be very helpful to have some additional information that tells us whether this is an internal evaluation of programs and or whether it also includes an external evaluation of programs, your contracted services, for example. If you could come back to us with a more detailed description of what is included in that program evaluation, it would be very helpful.
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are we going to move to a new section at this point?
We are about to do that. We have the program priority list to get through with Mr. Jester, as well as a shorter piece on administration, but I do want to give you an opportunity to...
I would appreciate hearing from the OYA folks a little more about their health care services and how they're provided, or if it's all contracted. We really have spent little to no time other than to know that it's within the treatment support. And even in our tours, we didn't get to that depth. We didn't spend enough time there to know, but I'd like to have a briefing on that.
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, let me give you an overview and we can come back with more specific information and detail. Within the facilities where the youth correctional facilities, we have medical clinics and we have either staff physicians or we have physicians on contract. There are daily sick calls where, at a minimum, a nurse will review a complaint by a youth, and then either that is triaged up to the doctor or it is taken out of the facility and to a through agreement community hospital where it would be seen. Emergencies are all taken out. We don't do any kind of emergency treatment inside our facility. So, for example, the contract we have for McLaren's at Meridian Park Hospital, if a young person suffered an injury that required immediate medical attention, that would be taken to Meridian Park. In the camp facilities, the medical is all youth going out to local doctors, clinics, or hospitals because the size 25 beds doesn't support a medical clinic in those environments. For youth that are in residential providers in foster care, they are eligible for Oregon Health Plan and they access services through that. Youth that are on parole to their own homes, it is a parental responsibility to address medical needs.
Madam Chair, follow up. Thank you. Where I wanted to get a little deeper, those that qualify for the health plan that are in the 25-bed or less facilities where you don't provide staffed medical, is that a contracted service or do they go out through the health plan provider list?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, if you are in a correctional facility, be it a transitional facility operated by the state or a youth correctional facility, you are by definition ineligible for the health plan. So it is general fund.
Then follow up. Then is it contracted or is it fee for service?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, it's all fee for service.
Representative Hanna, did you complete your questions?
Yes. I guess I would like to, as we get further into phase two, I'd like to see the numbers. I'd like to see what we're going to spend on health care and maybe some breakdown of how that looks, especially given that it's a fairly large population on a what seems like fee-for-service basis. There might be a savings opportunity there.
Very good. Representative Wisnett, and then we do need to move.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This will be quick. I just, in the next round, I think it'd be important, too, if OIA would bring back some information. Because of constituent issue I had, I've discovered that OIA tries to recover child support for any of their people in the system. And I've questioned about how much they do collect and how much effort and expenses is in collecting that money. So we might want to look at that and how that's back into the general fund and how that's used because they do collect, they try to collect support from everyone in the system.
Very good. And Ms. Baker's making a note here. Ms. Cole, you've done a great job.
Thank you so much.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hanna?
Go ahead. Okay. While we're going through a transition, I'd just like to introduce Cole Goodwin, who's been shadowing me today. And another job shadow from Gilkey.
I just let mine go. He didn't miss the bus. That's why I was out.
Sorry, Mr. Bus.
I was saying goodbye to mine.
It was 2:20, I think.
Is Cole Goodwin?
Yeah.
Would you like to come up and join the committee?
Okay.
Okay, Mr. Jester, we have about 59 minutes to get through the rest of our agenda. So,
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think that will be sufficient time to do that. At this time, I'd like to reintroduce Karen Olson, the Assistant Director for Business Services, who will talk briefly about administration, and then we'll work with me through the program priority list and the budget reduction option list. And then, with the permission of the chair, we would like to do a wrap-up. Mm-hmm.
Good afternoon again. I'm Karen Olson, the Assistant Director of Business Services with the Oregon Youth Authority, and I'll be starting on page 76 in your document.
Are these documents also over there on that table?
Yes, they are.
Ms. Cole is going to help you find the right documents and you can follow along. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. OYA administration provides leadership and direction, oversight, and centralized business services for the agency. It also has developed and is responsible for the ongoing operation of the Juvenile Justice Information System, which serves OIA and all county juvenile departments and provides information to numerous partner agencies. On the top of page 76 on the left, there's a chart that breaks administration down into four functional areas. I'm going to briefly go through each area. In the director's office, which is 8% of administration, you find the leadership, communication internally and externally. As Bob has talked about, we do have an internal auditing function. And the director's office also includes our minority services, which Mr. Jackson talked about the other day. Moving to the left on the chart, you see business services. This is the largest part of administration at 38%. We provide centralized support to all parts of the agency in terms of accounting, payroll, contracting, and contracting not only for the services that Ms. Cole spoke about, but also for services that are provided within our facilities. We also have a purchasing function. Obviously, we have a budgeting function because without it, we wouldn't have this book in this presentation today. And then information systems that support OIA. The third function within administration, excuse me, is what we call agency-wide. And this covers payments that are for the entire agency. For example, payments for the Secretary of State's audits, payments to the Department of Administrative Services for things that they provide, tort and property insurance premiums for the entire agency, and unemployment insurance, attorney general services. Those are things that are difficult to identify to specific portions of the agency, so we pay for them in administration. The last piece of this budget is the Juvenile Justice Information System. You can read about it on page 77, but there are three things that I'd like to leave you with. The first is one of the real benefits of the Juvenile Justice Information System is that youth is shared across the system among county juvenile departments and with OIA, so that when youth are transferred from one venue to the other, the staff can see certain facts about the youth, and it's very helpful in terms of providing services within the continuum. The second thing about JGIS is that it's efficient. You've got 37 entities utilizing the same system, and that provides for efficiency. The third thing is that JGIS has provided us with much of the data that we've been using this week, youth demographics, the recidivism data that Bob talked about, but also Suzanne Porter uses JGIS data for a forecast. The Secretary of State's office uses data for audits. And JGIS is used to provide data to the federal government on county uses of detention. I guess there's a fourth point I want to bring home, and that is the Youth Authority developed JGIS. It was developed on time, and it was developed within the budget.
Representative Hannah.
I'm going to ask this question, and I'm going to say ahead of time, I'm glad Senator Winters is not here for this. So some of it's been fun. Is JGIS one of the software programs moving into the scenic program?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah.
Just for fun. I can't tell you all of those acronyms, but I think you know what I'm talking about. Is this program moving into the centralized new building software program?
Representative Hannah, the database that stores the JGIS data and the data lines that we use to transmit that data among the counties and OIA will become a part of the new computing network infrastructure.
Is that scenic?
That's scenic.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Will it save you any money?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, we do not yet know what rates DAS is going to charge us for the storage and the network lines. I don't know if we'll see any savings.
Thank you.
Just for Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did the counties contribute to the JGIS costs, or did they just pay for their own costs of hooking up to it?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanson, the state paid for the development of JGIS through a series of federal burn grants. We also sold certificates of participation, which will be paid off in May, and then there was some state general fund. And the state pays for the storage of the database with DAS. It pays for all of the data lines. The county pays for anything that's sort of within their building.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Devlin?
More curiosity. Would any of the county juvenile detention centers, when they take someone in, presuming they had the person's true identity and all of that, be able to check these records?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, yes.
Even their custody personnel before admitting them would have that information?
Yes, they would.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, the outcome of JGIS has been a development of a seamless information system from the first point of contact and referral through termination of juvenile justice involvement, and at any point along the way, the mission is to be able to provide that access to detention workers, to juvenile park workers of a youth and their family move from one county to another, to be able to access that information and not lose the history.
Madam Chair, I only brought this up to differentiate OIA from the Department of Corrections, because Department of Corrections, when they were before us, identified that one of the problems that they have is when they get someone to admitting, they don't actually get a clear picture of their records until maybe a day later, because they don't have a system like this.
On page 78, going on, this is just for your information. We do have a secured website where authorized users can go to get information about JGIS, and page 78 is the page that is our what we call our report center, and individuals can go in and run pre-developed reports. They can also submit requests for their own reporting, and this is where we get a lot of the information that we've presented you today. On page 79, I've just got one last thing about JGIS, and that is we took JGIS and built a small subsystem which we now deliver over the web, and that's called the Juvenile Justice Partner System. And the intent of that system was to provide non-confidential case data specifically to non-juvenile justice public safety agencies. And we can provide youth name, county of jurisdiction, parent contact information. We have a number of county law enforcement agencies who now access what we call the Juvenile Justice Partner System. And I'll leave some brochures on that over on the table in case your local law enforcement might want access to that. They can contact their county juvenile department to get that. On the bottom of page 79, once again, this is the organization chart for the agency. You can see that administration has 6% of the FTE in the organization, and I've described the functions that we perform. on page 80, let's talk about measuring performance here. We talked a lot in this presentation about youth safety, but what's equally important to the organization is employee safety. And I've got two measures here, and I'm not using rates because I think sometimes looking at the raw data is a better indication of what's happening. The first thing we have on the top is these are claims either disabling in nature or where somebody's been awarded a permanent disability for work-related injuries. And you can see that the claims started out at 24 in 2001-2002, then they dropped. Then in 2003-2004, they went back up, and now they appear to be down again. We believe that that blip up in 2003-2004 occurred partly because we were closing facilities at that time, and people who had injuries that were potentially disabling filed claims on those. But now the claims appear to be going back down again. That's a good direction for us. Another measure that we look at is vehicle incidents and accidents. We get reports of the number of citizen complaints, citations, and actual accidents and incidents. We have gone down in 2004 from 21 to 16, and that's a good sign for us. We have potential to reduce our costs for property damage and insurance based on our reduction in safety issues and vehicle issues. I believe that ends my presentation. If you have any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
I'll leave at this point.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again for the record, Bob Jester, I would ask that you turn back in your budget books to page 31 under the overview section. It will be a fold-out document that looks like what you see on the board there with some narrative on the right-hand side of it. And at this time, I'd like to summarize the program service priorities for the Oregon Youth Authority. First priority in doing this exercise was, in fact, to prioritize services to the youth most at risk to commit future crimes. And doing that through approaches specifically targeted at reducing the criminogenic risk factors that you've heard discussed both yesterday by Ms. Rios, by Mr. Florip in facilities, and Ms. Cole in the field.
You're talking now, Mr. Jester, about the criteria.
Yes, ma'am.
Used to arrive at your priorities. Okay.
Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry, I was not clear about that. So I am speaking from the narrative section of the fold-out chart on page 31. Second, to develop and provide services that integrate and complement with other services provided within the juvenile justice system. And this, I think, gets right at the point that Ms. Cole brought up around the development of co-management agreements with county governments to best leverage the resources at the state level and not to duplicate but to complement and help fill in continuums of services and sanctions at the local level. And third, to maintain quality services for the target population by focusing on reducing capacity rather than compromising service integrity. And this has been a value that the Youth Authority has used throughout our 10-year history, that we want to continue to provide the highest level of services for youth that we have responsibility for. And we do not believe that it is a productive or prudent approach to thin the soup in regard to the kind of services we provide to those youth, but to look at how many youth we can serve with the dollars made available to the agency. And I'd like to start with the, now we're talking about the bar chart and the priorities. The first bar chart you see is the governor's recommended budget for the Oregon Youth Authority, and it is at the far left. I would like to point out that that budget starts 285 beds short of what you heard Sue Porter talk about yesterday in regards to the demand forecast. So the governor's budget does not include the beds that Ms. Porter was describing, the methodology to which those were quantified as being needed in the juvenile justice public safety arena. And if you will look, you start at the top with the yellow section, and that represents the dollars to juvenile diversion and juvenile crime prevention, and these are dollars that are passed through local governments. The red section is a section of dollars for our community and field services that Ms. Cole just presented. And the blue section represents the facilities, which Mr. Florp presented yesterday, and that's 850 bed capacity there. The green represents the section that Ms. Olson just presented, which is administration. And the gray section represents debt service and our government service charges to DAS. Our approach to looking at this exercise was to start by identifying those youth who are at less risk to public safety if they were not being served by the continuum of services that you have heard described over the past 4 days. Recognizing that the starting point of the cohort of youth that we will be trying to make sense out of who will not be served in further reduction, we are starting with the 0.5% of the 10 to 17 year old group in Oregon, half of a percent, which are the highest, most chronic offenders. So as we talk about our priorities, we are reducing the service level to that half a percent of Oregon's young people. So if you look at priority five, you start with the governor's recommended budget, you drop down to priority five, which reduces 50 closed custody beds and 29 positions, 3% of our community services, 5 positions, 35 residential and foster care placements, 3% of juvenile crime prevention, diversion, gang, and the associated administrative and support costs each of those levels. It's important for me to describe the impact of the reduction in capacity. The 50-bed reduction in closed custody is not a reduction of 50 youth that would move from one of our facilities or facilities back to community. That's the first piece of the reduction. But the impact of the reduction is that those beds will not be available for other youth who otherwise would have been committed by the courts into those beds. So a 50-bed reduction would equate to 150 youth not being served in facilities during the biennium. These youth would be pushed back to communities where they would then compete for services at the community level, which would include DHS, education, and juvenile departments. These are youth that currently are not successfully able to remain in the community and access those available services, keeping themselves and community safe, but through a decision by the court have moved into the state level of care, those youth would be pushed back into their communities to access those existing services, which on the Oregon Youth Authority side would be also reduced along with the beds. One of the great challenges that we have experienced in OYA with the reduction of capacity is, unlike the Department of Corrections that has determinate sentencing where you finish your sentence and then you get post-prison supervision, and it's a computation to identify when a given offender is going to leave, we have discretion, paroling discretion, over youth offenders who are committed. And it is a very, very difficult decision that Oregon Youth Authority staff have to make in partnership with local communities to determine who is at less risk to put out before the completion of the program services that have been designed in their individual case plans that you have heard described. And it is more than an issue of public safety, referring back to the two faces, the criminal activity as well as the social characteristics of these youth. There is an immediate concern on the criminality side with the continuation of law-violating behaviors, but as important, there are the social factors which are contributors to those crimes that are very difficult to access and manage in a less structured, less secure community setting. And that is why, as we have talked earlier, it is a combination of the criminal behavior and the need, the risk and need that bring them into our system. So these youth get returned to communities where it is a less secure environment to manage both the criminal behavior and provide for reformation. When we go to level four, we do more of what we did in level five. We reduce 100 additional close custody beds, more of the community services and positions, more residential foster care, juvenile crime prevention, and more administration. I would like to call to your attention level three, where you will now see that the yellow bar is no longer represented. And the yellow bar are those services that are provided in local communities through diversion and juvenile crime prevention. Because when we get to this level of prioritization, we must prioritize the youth at greatest risk to public safety and move into facility services and not the front end, both prevention and probation. So the reductions that you see in level three represent an elimination of the funding streams to local governments to provide for the continuum of prevention and intervention services that they are providing under diversion and juvenile crime prevention basic.
Mr. Jester, if I could just stop you just for a minute, having difficulty with language here. What you are referring to as level is actually priority?
Madam Chair, exactly. I'm sorry.
Okay. All right. Just want to make sure I'm tracking. Okay. Please continue.
Priority three eliminates the funding streams to local governments in diversion and juvenile crime prevention, and it eliminates the program area that Ms. Cole described as the front-end probation services to youth committed to the Youth Authority for placement in out-of-home care in residential or foster, but not yet to a youth correctional facility. So at priority 3, those services are eliminated. When you get to priority 2, we are now down to the mandated DOC population who we are serving in the youth correctional facilities and the public safety reserve youth only. There are no discretionary beds for counties. We are dealing solely with person-to-person offenders and public safety reserve level offenders, and the parole aftercare for those youth who are committed to those facilities by the juvenile court.
Representative Hanna.
Madam Chair, I hope I'm not confused on this issue, but Mr. Juster, why are we going to these levels? From my understanding from the co-chairs, that we were asking about a 10% cut. 10% is the, you know, is $24.68 million. And why are we going to a level of general fund reduction where up to 40.7?
Ms. Baker.
Maybe I can take a shot at that question, Madam Chair. Representative Hanna, what the agency has done is to say, rather than identifying certain pieces of our agency and programs as priorities, we are a system, and that to put things into priority order, we have to slice budgetarily, if you will, parts of that system. So you have the lowest priority in priority 5 is one part of that. Priority 4 is another part. And using the governor's budget as a starting point, they've separated into these 5 priority or level pieces. In terms of the budget reduction options that we'll be looking at, these do tie to those, but the intention was not to make them come up with more than a 10%, or in their case, we agreed to a 7.5% reduction option. But this is the way that they've described their priorities, if that helps.
May I follow up with that?
Mm-hmm, certainly.
Well, That helps me to some degree. I guess, and then for Ms. Baker or for Mr. Juster, right? I'm also wondering why the use of all general fund here, because if you start reducing general fund in the manner you're describing, will you not have a disproportionate loss of the federal matching funds where they apply?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, that's correct. The place where we have the matching funds is, in fact, in the field side, both in the pro-probation and substitute care side.
Okay, but follow-up, Madam Chair. So you're showing your graph is all general fund money. When you come over here to the priority levels and you know, priority 5 at $6 million. Is that all general fund? So you're not reflecting the change?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, that's correct. It's general fund.
Follow up once more. So if that's all general fund, you're not really reflecting what the total reduction would be because of the matching funds that would be available, are you?
That's correct. Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, that's correct.
Please continue.
Well, you can follow my thought process here. I mean, it's not that I don't appreciate the level of effort that went into this, because you went about it in a very systematic manner. But from this committee standpoint, it will be very difficult for us to recreate your budget adding back the federal loss that you would have on these. And that's going to be we're going to sit here doing a priority list trying to do that.
Madam Chair, on the chart that accompanies this, mm-hmm. you'll see all the fund types there. So we've provided you with all the information, but perhaps should have used total funds in our graphics.
Can we look at that?
Ms. Baker.
Karen, if you look at on the spreadsheet that the subcommittee is used to seeing, if you look at, for example, at the end, all the number fives, mm-hmm. if you add up the general fund there, wouldn't that equate to the $6 million for priority five, and then we would add up the other in federal funds to get the other impacts to address the question that Representative Hanna is interested in?
Ms. Baker, that's correct.
Does that help?
Could you repeat that one more time?
If you look on their spreadsheet,
right.
at towards the end, all the number fives in the left-hand column, and you go over and you add up all the general fund for that, that would total to the $6 million general fund that's on the front page with this chart where it's showing the $6 million here. So that's the general fund impact. And then to get to the equivalent other funds and federal funds that isn't shown on the front page but would be a concern as you're doing your priorities,
mm-hmm.
you would just add up those lines of other and federal funds. So we can do that for you when you get to that point.
Okay.
I want to make sure that this is...
Yeah, I just think but if, mm-hmm. if all we were doing was looking at this,
mm-hmm.
you wouldn't have had that idea.
Right, right.
And so it's mm-hmm. critical to understand that it's not just general fund money.
Right. It is a confusing
yeah.
presentation without doing what we're doing, which is asking a
okay.
lot of questions. Good questions. Representative Hanson.
For those of us who are somewhat numerically challenged, is there a rule of thumb like 5% or something that we could apply? If you reduce the general fund $6 million, could we take a ballpark guess at reducing the federal funds by
5 or 6%?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanson, I believe that we could do that. The difficulty is that the Youth Authority, the closed custody system, the facility system, receives very little federal money. It's almost 100% general fund.
School, just lunch?
Food you get a federal lunch subsidy program is the primary federal fund offset in facilities. Everything else is straight general. So we could do that computation. There are computations in the field in terms of our parole and probation staff, foster care, res providers, and we can provide you with that. This was intended to be more of a pictorial, high-level view of the choices, remembering that the targets that the agencies are given are general fund targets. And that's what we've displayed on this. The detail, of course, follows that. And it might be helpful, Madam Chair, to, if you would turn to page 34, we could specifically talk about the reduction exercise that we did.
Before we do that, let's stay with Representative Hanna.
Well, I want to follow up on a thought,
on this track. Mm-hmm.
Representative Hanson, that
mm-hmm.
that you're, I would not think 5% is the number we're talking about. I mean, you used that number, and I'm not sure you thought that was
no.
right, but
no.
if you total their general and other fund percentage of their total budget, it's almost 16%. So you'd want to be cautious. I mean, it's going to be really difficult to take the way they, in my view, it would be very difficult to take what they laid out on a in their categorical cut and use a generalized number because the matching fund wouldn't be the same within each category. It would only apply, if you said, to the entire budget, but within categories, that'd be a statistically difficult thing to come up with. Yeah.
You wanted to take us to page 34?
Madam Chair, on page 34, what you see is the impact of the 7.5% reduction. And the reason that the Youth Authority was given a target of a 7.5% reduction was that in the governor's recommended budget, we took a 12.5% reduction over what would have been essential service level. and the agreement was that we would put forward 7.5 additional percent. And what we did in terms of process, we used the same criteria that we spoke of earlier in prioritizing the overall piece, but we brought together partners and stakeholders, staff, and talked about if here's the budget pie, and if we need to make a 7.5% reduction, give us your best thinking on where that reduction should come from. Should it come from the prevention side? Should it come from the probation side? Should it come from facilities, providers? And what we came up with was, in fact, shrinking that pie by the 7.5%, and that's what you see represented up here. So this is the 7.5% reduction where you bring this pie in all equal sections of the agency's operation.
Shrinking the pie proportionately.
Yes, ma'am.
Is what you're saying.
And the effect of that is the elimination of 150 close custody beds, 75 foster care residential beds, a $1.4 million reduction from juvenile crime prevention, diversion, and gang, along with 12 positions from parole and probation, and approximately a 6% I'm becoming dyslexic, 6% reduction from administration in that pie.
What you're presenting now through that chart relates back to the information on page 31 and the priority levels that you've started to walk us through.
Madam Chair, you're absolutely correct. And this reduction takes us to priority 4. They directly match up.
Okay. Representative Hansen, did you have a question?
Not yet.
Okay.
Not at this time.
All right. Please continue.
Madam Chair, I know that we have been asked to come back on Monday and have further discussion with this committee about the priorities. What I would like to do is to provide answers to questions that were raised both Tuesday and Wednesday from our testimony and do a brief wrap-up and come back to this on Monday if that is supported by you and your members.
What's the pleasure of the committee? Do you have further questions around the program prioritization? Representative Hansen and then Representative Hanna.
Okay, this is a pretty generic question, but looking back at recidivism rates and the numbers of offenders, we've seen significant, really significant improvement over the last few years. And yet this is at the same time that your budgets have been cut. And so I guess what I'm asking is, as we cut your budgets before, since really going back to the special sessions after the 01, what have we lost?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, your agency is doing what I would consider a pretty tremendous job looking at page 22 and 23. We've cut your budget. Why wouldn't, and I'm kind of the devil's advocate on this too, why wouldn't we expect these numbers to continue going if we cut it even further?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I think that's a very fair question, and I think part of the answer you will absolutely hear during the public testimony section of Phase 2. from partners and stakeholders in the community who have received these youth without services and have had to absorb some of that into other budgets at the expense of other reductions. I would suggest that you might hear some of that from education and some of the challenges they have had with some youth that are not equipped to be in a public school setting, that have been returned to the community, or there's not an option or alternative for them to go. I would suggest you would see this in the homeless population in some of our large cities. I would suggest you would see this with the increased drug use. I would suggest you would see this with the increased demand on mental health services. So I don't believe that we have always in juvenile justice stepped to the plate and have done the very best job we could do with that which is provided to us by the legislature. And I don't want anyone to believe that those choices or the outcomes have not been without a lot of compromise in communities.
If I could just make a quick statement,
mm-hmm,
and that's, I first, probably my heaviest involvement with this issue goes back to the 1990 when I started on the county commission. And we were in an absolute mess. We had, we were doing very little or nothing with kids that had minor problems. We ignored their conduct until they had sometimes a dozen brushes with the juvenile authority, with the locally. I think we were operating with less than 200 beds at that point. There was an evolution. Part of that was what drove Measure 11 and some pretty draconian impacts on 18 through 15 year olds. Looking at these numbers between 95 and 03, it looks like we're finally getting a handle on things and finally making progress. At the same time, we've had to cut back. I'm really concerned in terms of when do we get to that tipping point when we start undoing the progress that we've made over the last decade. And I think it's... I don't know when we get to that tipping point, but my sense is we're pretty close to it now. And I'd like to understand that dynamic better before I do my prioritizations.
Did you wish to comment or respond?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen and I worked together in that same period of time in Multnomah County looking at the diversion plan for the county. And I believe that you're absolutely right. Where is that tipping point? I think it depends on where you sit, whether we have passed it or whether we are up to it now. And depending on what portion of the population, if you are a young woman's advocate, you would say that we have passed the tipping point, that we have reduced the level of access to the point that we are serving 17% young women and 83% young men overall and 93% young men in our facilities and 7% young women. So you would hear from them that there is not access to appropriate levels of service. If you look at some of the youth in the communities that are not getting appropriate access to services that otherwise would have been provided either with the state and county partnerships in leveraging both sets of resources, I think that is represented by some of the issues that we see daily in our cities and in rural areas. I mean, I don't think it is any longer just an urban issue. Juvenile crime prevention. I mean, those dollars have, you know, reduced from, you know, $20 million to, I believe, $5 million. And, you know, that earlier prevention, it is a cumulative effect. I mean, you can't isolate out, which I think if I don't leave the committee with any thought, you can't isolate out the services a youth authority has funded and provides from those services that other agencies also provide and how they are interlocked together. And that includes DHS. It absolutely includes county-level services, and it absolutely includes education. So when you look at the combination of those, Oregon Youth Authority is a piece of that continuum and serves in conjunction with other agencies some of these youth. You pull, you know, us out of that continuum, and I think, again, you will see what some of the concerns are from the public testimony that you will hear in phase two.
On another subject, but related, I'd like to have a better sense of whether we are exhausting all creativity in seeking federal funds for transitional services for all levels of services. And particularly concerned about whether we are capturing all the available opportunities around mental health, sex offender treatment, in those areas, those three areas where Ms. Cole told us we are most efficient in capacity, drug and alcohol. And I'd like to have a better sense of what the collaboration looks like around seeking federal funds. When you are looking out at what those opportunities might be, who are your partners? And again, just trying to get a sense of whether we're exhausting all creativity in looking at those opportunities.
Madam Chair, we'd be happy to provide that information for you. One thing I would like to mention is that on the national level, there has been increased discussion and conversation, particularly around the access of federal mental health dollars to follow youth and adult offenders who may have access to services in the community and then move into correctional settings, that those service dollars should follow them. You know, now there is a wall at the wall, so to speak, and once you're inside, that becomes a general fund responsibility. And there is increasing interest on the other 49 states' part to look at that national policy and see if it doesn't make sense that those services should follow youth as they go through through juvenile corrections or adult corrections and back in their communities, similar to how education dollars are provided.
And another thought also related is with the methamphetamine epidemic, and given what will certainly be the treatment needs and all of that around youth coming into our system, who is looking at how that whole piece gets organized? Again, looking at the grant opportunities. Can you speak to that now? Is there some conversation taking place somewhere that says we want to make sure that Oregon gets its share of dollars that may be coming to the states for this purpose?
Madam Chair, I would be more comfortable and probably more complete to have that answer put together. I can tell you that we routinely partner with counties. We routinely partner with DHS. We routinely partner with DOC in looking at any kind of federal grant opportunities that would provide benefit to the clients that we serve and are sustainable.
Yeah, I just don't have a sense yet that we are working our way toward a systemic approach to capturing federal funds for a whole lot of purposes related to the methamphetamine epidemic. Ms. Baker, do you have anything to contribute to my question?
Not at this time.
Okay. Not to put you on the spot. Okay. Would you like to continue? We have 10 minutes left, so...
Sure.
Are you in a place where you want to wrap up?
Actually... We had previously provided to this committee written responses to questions that were raised during our testimony on Monday. What Ms. Baker from LFO is handing out to you now our written responses to all of the questions and issues that were raised by this committee during our testimony on Tuesday and Wednesday of this week. We certainly don't have time, Madam Chair, to go through all of these. What I would like to suggest is that committee members would have the opportunity to look at these materials. If there are further questions, we are back Monday, and we are also back during Phase 2. A couple of things I would like to point out. The two faces chart is included here now, revised with both the percentages and the numbers that fall into those categories. We have broken out information by gender and ethnicity at the request of the committee. We have further drilled down into research and data available on faith-based services. We have provided the complete performance-based standards list, which is 105 different performance measures that we track and monitor within the Youth Authority.
Very good. We appreciate your timely response to the questions, and this will be additional homework for the committee over the weekend, and you can expect that when you're back on Monday, we'll want to walk through the material. Representative Hannah?
Madam Chair, thank you. I'd like to make sure as we proceed through Phase 2 that either from Mr. Jester or through Sheila or the appropriate LFO staff person, that we get a very complete description of the juvenile crime prevention programs that are both within OYA and State Children and Family Services, including the dollar amounts within each of those programs, and that we could break that discussion down pretty clearly.
I would think we would want to add the commission.
The Criminal Justice Commission.
And the Children's Commission.
What the governor's budget proposes, Madam Chair, is to take the juvenile crime prevention money that was in the Criminal Justice Commission, move it to the Commission on Children and Families, so we do have some additional information on that we can bring in.
Very good.
Madam Chair, I think I'm a sponsor of that bill, so I may have to.
Representative Hansel.
Well, I think Mr. Lemon is possibly the resident expert on those programs. As the
of those in the room, I would say yes, Representative Hansel.
Okay. Well, don't look up here.
Mr. Jester, please continue.
Madam Chair, in closing out the week's opportunity to testify before this committee, first and foremost, I would like to thank you and the members for, I think, engaging the Youth Authority in probably one of our most productive conversations with the Legislative Committee. I very much appreciate the questions. I very much appreciate the interest that's been shown on the part of all members, and I think that your questions have kind of push the envelope in terms of us going back and rethinking some of the materials that we have presented. And Representative Hannah, we will certainly, you know, be looking at the presentation of the priorities in a way that makes more sense to committee members. It is timely. This is our 10th anniversary. We were an agency created in 1995, and it's now 2005. The vision for the Youth Authority was a public safety agency with the heart of child welfare. I think that was the vision. And I believe that the Youth Authority has risen to the occasion to keep that balance and that perspective. I think as then Attorney General Kulongowski described it, a public safety agency with the heart of child welfare. And we have attempted to institutionalize that and make it part of our culture. our priorities remain around reducing juvenile crime as measured through recidivism. We want to emphasize public safety but continue our emphasis on evidence-based treatment and best practice. I do want to point out that the Youth Authority is responsible for youth who are at their peak years of committing crimes, which are the 15 to 24-year-old age bracket. That's the most activity of any cohort in terms of age and committing of crimes. And I would be absolutely remiss if I did not state as the director that I think you have heard from some of Oregon's best and brightest assistant administrators as they have presented, and they are backed up by an Oregon Youth Authority field and facilities and private providers who have done the services that we have presented, and our central support folks, information services, our research and data people, and absolutely our budget people are, I think, the best in state government. And it's an agency that I am very proud to lead. And I again want to thank you for the opportunity to present before you.
We appreciate those comments, Mr. Jester. And I would just say to you that, and this is reflecting on the week that we've spent with you and the agency, I'm reminded of Representative Representative Hansen's challenge and comments about the culture of the organization, given some recent serious challenges that you're facing. And I would hope that you are looking at an external review, someone who could provide an external review of the culture of the organization, as well as that internal review that we've heard you discuss. I think the internal look as well as the external look will help you get the most complete picture of what are the learnings and what are the next steps. So as we visit again, if not on Monday, but definitely in phase two, if we could come back to that conversation with your reflections on how you see moving forward on Representative Hansen's concern, which is all of our concern, it would be very helpful.
Absolutely.
Okay. Oh, we have an announcement from Mr. Wilson, Doug Wilson.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, I just want to make sure that Monday we will be working on prioritization and to bring your materials for Department of Corrections and what you have in front of you for OYA. We will be bringing in a few materials, including a new agency-wide prioritization sheet for those agencies, but one that just adds a column for your use as subcommittee. So that is on Monday, and I guess I think tomorrow there'll be some more discussion full about the prioritization process.
Thank you, Jeff. And again, thank you all very much for what has been a good week and outstanding presentations. Thank you.
Thank you.
And adjourned.